This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The case of a 9-year-old boy from Goodfield charged with murder is a tragic and riveting one.
It's getting the press it is because it is such an extraordinary and unusual route to choose with a child so young.
Elizabeth Clark of the Juvenile Justice Initiative based in Evanston says the case is all the more tragic because of the unusual charge. Plus, the upside and downside of hard scrape in gardening with WGLT's podcast Grow. An embarrassing oops from the Next to Normal Story Slam folks. And stem cell therapy is not just for humans. How about a study in Bloomington for dogs with arthritis?
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. When Central Illinois learned that a 9-year-old boy was accused of setting a fire that killed 5 people in Goodfield, many people asked the same question. Can you charge a kid with murder when he's that age? Yes, you can, but whether you should is another matter. Woodford County State's Attorney Greg Minger says it wasn't an easy decision, but he stood by it this week as the boy made his first court appearance in Woodford County. WGLT's Ryan Denham spoke with Elizabeth Clark of the Juvenile Justice Initiative based in Evanston. She says it's a tragic case made even more shocking by the unusual charge.
It's just out of line to charge a child so young on the criminal side of the juvenile court, completely out of line with other developed countries, completely out of line with the world consensus on what's fundamentally fair for children. This is just unheard of and shocking.
So what other options would the Woodford County State's Attorney have had?
The international consensus is that children under the age of 14 lack the mental capacity to be held criminally responsible. And that's because their brains haven't fully matured, they're still impulsive, it's just by definition, neurologically, they're not old enough to understand. I think that came through in some of the reporting with the child not understanding some of the legal terms, for example, alleged and so forth. And if they can't understand, then they can't make the kind of participate and make the legal decisions that are necessary to participate in a criminal proceeding. So it's a worldwide consensus that young children who end up in conflict with the law should be given services, not sanctions. So the court should do everything they can to look at the case individually and see what led to the issue and what can be done to restore the youth and the community to the extent possible and help everyone to move on.
So if the boy is too young for a criminal prosecution, as you've just laid out, what other options would exist for a county like Woodford County to pursue some sort of treatment or services or to put this child in some sort of different environment than they were before?
The juvenile court has always been divided into two sides. You have a child welfare side for young children and also for children who are abused and neglected. And you have another side of the court that's the delinquency or the so-called criminal side. And those two sides of the court are there for a reason, in part because you want to be able to offer protections and resources and services to young children who find themselves in some kind of trouble or difficulty. And you also want the other side of the court, the delinquency side, is for a limited form of culpability, but also rehabilitation. This kid is just too young for that kind of culpability determination, so it should have entered the court through the child welfare side.
And does that side, the child welfare track, provide options for requiring psychological treatment services, those types of things?
It entails everything that the other side has. It just doesn't have the punishment. So it doesn't have the option of probation or detention, but it has all of the resources. But both sides have as many resources as the court and the community can imagine for services.
The state's attorney in this instance would have some discretion, right? It's not like the statute was forcing his hand on a murder charge, right? I mean, it sounds like from what you're saying, he did have the discretion to do something else, and he chose this route.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and it's getting the press it is, because it is such an extraordinary and unusual route to choose with a child so young.
You know, I'm a layman here. I think a lot of our listeners are not plugged into the daily machinations of juvenile justice. They don't know case history. I don't know case history necessarily. So this is unusual, right? We're not just making that up, that this is an unusual charging decision for a boy this age.
It's thankfully unusual in the U.S. It's unheard of in the rest of the developed world. I mean, shocking and unheard of in the rest of the world. But yes, absolutely unusual in the U.S. The interesting thing is the U.S. has all of the research, all of the neurological brain development research that shows that children are not capable of comprehending legal concepts, are not, their brains are not fully developed so that they can be held fully like an adult, culpable for their actions. I mean, there's a reason we don't let children under the age of 16 drive cars. We just raised the age of tobacco to 21. There's a reason that we set these higher age limits, and it's because children's brains are not fully developed yet. But we just have to recognize this in terms of culpability as well as in terms of allowing them the privileges of adulthood.
Because the maximum penalty is still only probation at this point. So I guess what is the downside of putting a 9-year-old through a process that may ultimately just lead to probation?
First of all, it's stigmatizing and it's traumatic, as well as being unnecessary. So stigmatizing and traumatic to the child, it is, you can see all of the media attention that it's getting that makes it difficult for everyone involved in the situation. But also it's just not appropriate. It gets in the way of getting the kinds of services and resources that this child and the family need in order to begin to even think about some form of healing and moving on. And that's why the world community says 14 should be the minimum age. I mean, obviously, everybody has in their head a figure where below which it would be absurd. It would be absurd to take a 2-year-old and prosecute a 2-year-old. Well, in the worldwide consensus, it's absurd to prosecute criminally a child under the age of 14. And it's not a recent development. For 30 years, the Convention on the Rights of the Child has called for a reasonable minimum age of prosecution. And that was interpreted to be 12. It's 12 in Canada, it's 12 in Mexico, and recently it was clarified that no, that's 14. It's been 14 in Germany, for example, for decades. So this is nothing new to the rest of the world grappling with this issue of, you know, where is that line drawn? It's new to Illinois because we have no minimum age. And this is really shocking because we're the home of the world's first juvenile court. So we should have grappled with this 30 years ago when the rest of the world began doing it as well.
Are there any efforts underway in Illinois to sort of better align our criminal code, our juvenile justice laws, to kind of that international benchmark of 14 years old?
Yes, there are resolutions filed in the House and Cook County and the city of Chicago, all to ask our officials to look, just examine the fundamental international human rights for children in conflict with the law and compare them with what we have in Illinois. And really, based on this very long and proud Illinois history of being the world's first juvenile court, there was recently out of the UN a global study on deprivation of liberty of children. And it said, looking around the world, the most important achievement that has protected children all these years has been the development worldwide of children's courts. That came out of Illinois 130 years ago. I mean, it's extraordinary. We just have to make sure that our policies and practices in our courts are aligned with the rest of the world, particularly in terms of minimum age prosecution.
Killed in the April 6th fire in Goodfield were Catherine Murray, Jason Wall, Rose Allwood, Damian Wall, and Ariel Wall. Ryan Denham spoke with Elizabeth Clark of the Juvenile Justice Initiative based in Evanston. The 9-year-old boy accused of setting the fire is due back in court November 22nd.
Support for WGLT comes from Constitution Place Self-Storage, offering storage units in six sizes, your choice of regular or climate-controlled. Located just north of Empire and Linden, next to Constitution Trail in Bloomington. Rental information at 829-1700 or constitutionplace.net. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a look at a new medical study involving dogs, big dogs. A McLean County man is looking for ways to help others, even as he battles for his life. WGLT's Eric Stock reports Earl Boitnot's co-workers are returning the favor.
For 21 years, Earl Boitnot of Hudson has done it all at the Bloomington Public Works Department.
Sweep streets, picked up debris and dirt out of the streets, tore out sidewalks, replaced curbs, basically everything down there I've pretty much had a little part of.
Recently, Boitnot started losing weight fast. He wasn't feeling well. 2 weeks ago, the 45-year-old complained of a headache. He wanted to go home and rest. His wife, Gina, insisted he go to the doctor.
And I made him go in, and we described his symptoms to the nurse, and the nurse told me I had a migraine. So I told the doctor his symptoms, and the doctor said, let's do a CT. And that's when we found the tumor.
It was an inoperable brain tumor. The GBM, or glioblastoma multiforme, grew to the size of a golf ball in only a few months. Doctors estimate Boitnot has about a year and a half to live if he responds to treatment.
That's when you just say, well, we're going to make the best of it.
Wife Gina was grateful he got it checked out when he did.
We were told in the ER, well, actually by the neurosurgeon, had he not been taken to the ER that day, or soon, because he was fighting it, he would have only lived another week and a half.
The Boitnot family now faces what AFSCME union representative Renee Nessler calls astronomical medical bills. She and Boitnot's co-workers are pitching in to help a man who has done a lot for them.
Earl, Gina, and their sons are selfless individuals that are always there when someone is in need. Earl has always been the first to show up and the last one to leave when helping others with projects.
AFSCME is putting on a benefit for Boitnot next month, returning the favor to a family that's known for helping friends with their handiwork. Boitnot shrugs off his own charity as no big deal.
I didn't do anything for money. Usually I just went over and helped them, and we do roofs and stuff like that on the side and just for them. And never wanted anything. And now they're doing this on me. I'm like, kind of makes me feel bad a little bit.
Boitnot figures his days are numbered. He had to retire from his job, and he needs help to walk. There are a few things that get him up every morning. One of them is the birth of his first grandson, expected in December.
I was kind of being a little selfish, so I want to see them come through and be able to hug them and hold on to them as long as I can. And hopefully I can get enough of that time. And then after that, whatever happens, happens.
Boitnot says he's at peace.
The relief, you know, I feel better. I'm going to pass away, and hopefully I can touch some people along the way and maybe get a smile or two out of myself and maybe make them smile. And it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And that's what makes me keep going.
And Boyd not wants his story to be a lesson for others. If you aren't feeling well, he says, get checked.
If I can help somebody maybe have that little headache and then they go in and just get checked out or something to help them where it don't get this bad, and maybe they have a little more time.
Boyd not says he knows his time is short, but he hopes he can save some for others before it's too late. I'm Eric Stock.
The cancer benefit for Earl Boynton will be Sunday, November 3rd from noon to 5 at the Moose Lodge on IAA Drive in Bloomington. The event will feature food, live music, a silent auction, raffle, bake sale, and more.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we head to London, once the beating heart of global exploration, to find out what discovery looks like these days. We speak to undersea explorers, a time use expert, a soccer savant, and the mayor of London, who hints that his city might be interested in a little independence of its own.
I love the sound of El Presidente.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. It's Freakonomics Radio, Saturday at 6 p.m. on WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for WGLT comes from the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the Southern Fried Chicks Comedy Tour on Friday, October 25th. The all-female cast brings free-range, blue-collar comedy to every show. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a look at what the state capitol bill hath wrought for roads in Bloomington Normal. Eric Stock has that story. Medical science is always advancing, even for pets. And Bloomington Normal is the site of a new study on Fido, Spot, and Lassie. Eastland Companion Animal Hospital wants dog owners whose pets are big dogs with arthritis to participate in a stem cell therapy study. WGLT student reporter Darnisha Mitchell talks with Dr. Kathy Petrucci, the founder and CEO of Animal Cell Therapies, which is working with Eastland Companion Animal Hospital. She talks about this study and then about stem cells.
Stem cells are primitive cells that live in the body normally. They're much more present when we're younger, which is why we heal so much faster when we're younger. They have the ability to sort of turn into other cell types depending on what the body is signaling. So, for example, with our cells, these are mesenchymal cells or mesenchymal cells. They can turn into cartilage or bone or fat or tendon. So that's why we're using them to treat osteoarthritis. We also think that they help the body heal by reducing inflammation and secretion of different types of growth factors that also help reduce inflammation. They work with the immune system and they help the body repair itself.
Can you explain what is a double-blind placebo-controlled study for anyone who doesn't know?
Yes. So a double-blind study is when the owner does not know or the doctor does not know what group the animal is in. So, for example, one group will receive the stem cells and the other group will receive nothing, which will be the placebo.
So walk us through the actual procedure of the stem cell injection that will be put into the dogs to treat arthritis.
Yeah, so the dogs that receive the stem cells will be sedated, and depending on what joints are affected, they will receive up to two injections in the joint, and they will also receive a IV dose of stem cells.
So why was the umbilical cord derived stem cells selected to treat arthritis in dogs?
Well, we've looked at a lot of different sources for stem cells. We've looked at fat, we looked at bone marrow, we did a little bit of embryonic. Embryonic cells are a lot more unpredictable. The bone marrow cells are more difficult to work with. They're less predictable. And the fat cells, we didn't think they were as potent as the umbilical-derived cells. Umbilical-derived cells are a little bit younger as a source, so they're a little bit more predictable in their growth rates and their potency rates. They're also very easy to collect. We obtain umbilical cord stem cells from donors. The tissue would be normally thrown away. So there's no surgery required. There's no extra, biopsies to obtain fat. There's no aspiration of bone marrow, from research animals. So it's a good source, really nice ethical source of stem cells.
And how are these stem cells retrieved? Like, what is the process to choosing this umbilical cord-derived stem cell?
Well, we have a very strict donor eligibility process. This is all overseen by FDA. So the puppies and the mother have to be healthy. They're seen a couple of times. They're seen before the puppies are born. The mother is seen before the puppies are born. And then the puppies and the mother are seen by the vet at 8 weeks. So the mother and the cord itself are all screened for a whole bunch of different infectious agents. So they have to be clear of any diseases. The cells themselves are also tested for infectious agents, bacteria, mycoplasma, endotoxin, a couple of times. So we have to make sure that they're safe.
So how did Eastland Companion Animal Hospital get involved in the study?
Well, they've participated in past studies with us. So they are one of 25 study partners that we've had across the United States.
So how has using umbilical cord for stem cells been used for pets before? And if it has been, like, what has been the results? What has been the feedback from these previous studies?
Well, we've had good results. We did a study at University of Florida. It was elbows only, and we had success with that study. We conducted a large study last year. We had good success in dogs under 70 pounds. We had fewer success in dogs over 70 pounds, so we changed our dose. Which is why we are doing this study where we are only allowing dogs that are 70 pounds and over in this particular study.
So for anyone not familiar with pets stem cell study, how common is this therapy that's used for pets?
Well, it's definitely a new technology. We are seeking FDA approval, so there are no commercially available it's called allogeneic cell types. So a donor cell type. Actually, there are no FDA-approved products yet on the market for stem cell therapy. So we're hoping to be one of the first, if not the first, FDA-approved product for animals.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Darnisha Mitchell talking with Dr. Kathy Petrucci about a local study on stem cell therapy to treat dogs with arthritis. Stem cell therapy has been a controversial topic because of suspected ethical issues. Is it less controversial when it comes to pets versus humans?
Well, I think a lot of the controversy has come from the misunderstanding of the cell types. When stem cell therapy first started, or the research in stem cells first started, it was centered around embryonic use or fetal tissue use. And so, it's controversial to use embryos or fetal tissue for a treatment for anything. So the fact that we're using a disposable tissue as our cell source makes it not controversial at all.
With the study that Eastland Animal Hospital is doing, do they only plan on focusing on pets? Can this treatment be branched out to humans down the road?
We are conducting a small preclinical study as well with Mayo Clinic for spinal cord injuries. So we're hoping at some point that this can be brought to the human market as well.
Talk a little bit about, I know you mentioned that dogs have to be 70 pounds or over, but talk a little bit more about who qualifies for the study, how many participants will be involved, and how to get involved in the study.
So dogs have to be 1 year of age or older, and they have to be 70 pounds or greater. They have to have up to two joints that are affected. So if a dog has arthritis all over its body, multiple joints, then they won't qualify. Dogs also can't have any sort of neurologic issues that make it hard to evaluate their progress or lack of progress. And they have to be sort of generally healthy, you know, expected to survive, you know, a 1 month study.
And I know that there's a follow-up exam after the procedure. What do you check for in a follow-up exam?
The follow-up exam is at 30 days. So we're looking for how well the dog has done over the last month. The vet will do a lameness exam, an orthopedic exam, and the owner will fill out a questionnaire.
That's Dr. Kathy Petrucci of Animal Cell Therapies talking with WGLT student reporter Darnisha Mitchell about a new stem cell therapy study for arthritic dogs being done at Eastland Companion Animal Hospital in Bloomington. Dogs eligible for the study, again, must weigh 70 pounds or more, be a year of age or older, be in general good health, have arthritis in up to two joints of the knee, hip, elbow, or shoulder, and have all four functioning limbs. The scientists are hoping to have 50 to 100 dogs in the study. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A long walk is a story coming your way in just a few minutes. Now let's lead off with several high-traffic streets in Bloomington Normal being included on a project list for the state's capital plan. WGLT's Eric Stock has more.
State routes across the Twin Cities will get a major makeover over the next 6 years. The Illinois Department of Transportation this week has set aside $23.5 billion in planned road work and bridge repairs statewide. That includes $173 million for McLean County projects. Bloomington Public Works Director Jim Cart says it's a big deal.
Every state route in the city of Bloomington that has not already been addressed in recent years is going to get addressed in the next 5 years. This is going to be some major improvements for our citizens.
The projects include $18 million to rehab almost 5 miles of U.S. Route 51, also known as Main and Center Streets, between College Avenue and Normal, south to Olive Street in Bloomington. The state will spend nearly $11 million to finish up resurfacing on Veterans Parkway, this time south of Washington Street and north of Clearwater Avenue. And Illinois Route 9 will be rehabbed as it stretches east and west across Bloomington, covering Market, Henshaw, Locust, Towanda, and Empire Streets. Cart says the Route 9 project has the added safety benefit of removing the state route designation from Lee Street, which cuts through a neighborhood and past Bent Elementary School. It'll move to nearby U.S. 51, which runs parallel to Lee.
That is a big deal.
Normal Public Works Director Wayne Aldridge says the Route 51 project will be among the most visible. He says they've been asking IDOT to do that stretch for years.
There's sections that are really in poor state of repair. It's a good maintenance type project that needs to be done.
Aldridge says the full scope is yet to be determined, but it apparently will include widening existing pavement, ADA improvements, and traffic signal modernization. You can find a full list of McLean County projects at our website, WGLT.org. For the leadoff, I'm Eric Stock.
Listen to the leadoff every morning on 89.1 FM or subscribe to it wherever podcasts are found or on NPR One. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The first person to walk the entire Rock River Trail ended his hike in the Quad Cities. 87-year-old Lyle Lidholm walked more than 300 miles from Horicon, Wisconsin to Rock Island. Zach Wilson has more.
After 320 miles, Lidholm has walked his way home. The Moline-born Korean War veteran began his hike on September 1st and averaged just over 6 miles per day. Lidholm, who has lived in Wisconsin since he was 4 years old, says he met plenty of people along the way who offered him money, a meal, or a ride.
One guy ran a sporting goods shop, and he looked at my boots and saw that they had a little wear on them. He went in the back room and brought out a pair of boots worth $150 and gave them to me.
He first started hiking as a Boy Scout in 1944, but he didn't hike long distances until he retired in 1997. In 2000, he attempted to hike the 2,200-mile Appalachian Trail, but ended his journey after 800 miles due to breaking his foot. A decade later, he successfully hiked the 1,200-mile Ice Age National Scenic Trail in Wisconsin during the winter. Comparatively, Lidholm says, this hike has been much easier.
The only thing was I was held up by a nasty dog for about 15 minutes. Then there was rain, and then I made a few wrong turns. Other than that, it's been pretty smooth.
He says he doesn't feel any aches or pains at the end of his trek. When asked whether this would be the last one, he left it open-ended.
Oh, I'm a dreamer, so I'll finish this one. And then we'll see.
If he is still in good physical shape, Lidholm says he would love to conquer the 300 miles between the Irish Sea and the English Channel. I'm Zach Wilson.
Custom Turf by Evergreen FS. FS Custom Turf offers complete lawn and tree care services to preserve the health of yards, trees, and shrubs. Products and services detailed at evergreen-fs.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
Hardscrape can add interest to your landscaping with river rock, boulders, and flagstones. In this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy tells WGLT's Mike McCurdy there's a way to make it all look natural. He offers some warnings, though, regarding the downside of hardscrapes.
There's one part of your yard, garden, or landscaping that can remain the same no matter how much you care for all of the rest of it. We're talking hardscape, rocks, stones, gravel, outcropping, flagstones, and other hardscaping features. This is WGLT's gardening podcast, Grow, with our expert Patrick Murphy of Illinois State University's School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Patrick, thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
If someone doesn't already have hardscape, now might be the time to plan for it or install it as the weather turns cooler and there's not much to do outside?
Well, it's certainly an advantage to having cooler working conditions, and a lot of times bringing the stones into the landscape is going to require a little bit of dirt level work, so you can start with the small stuff, the decorative stones and gravels. These are typically made from naturally occurring materials found in any given area. If you can think of a location, there's a way to kind of pinpoint what kind of stone you should be using.
So is it best to keep it local or keep it looking natural by mimicking what can be found locally?
I think that's the best way to put it, because it looks natural that way. And we'll talk about when you don't do that, you get a look that's not as natural, not as uniform, and looks a little bit out of place.
You might not be able to put your finger on it, but you know something doesn't quite look right.
Yes, but especially after you see what's going on in somebody else's yard, you make the comparisons, you learn a little bit. Yeah, I agree with that.
So, for instance, we don't have a lot of lava rock here, but you can go to the big box store and buy lava rock.
That's right, and it's cheaper because stones are usually sold by the pound. The lava rocks are,
porous.
They're interesting and they're porous. You can carve a hole in a lava rock with a hand tool and plant something in it, and it'll grow there. But lava rocks are consistent with what you might find on the coast, and there could be a situation where they look a little bit out of place for the public view of your landscaping. So maybe if you have the opportunity to use those materials, you want to keep it related to a theme garden, maybe something coastal in appearance. Japanese gardens use lots of these kinds of black stones, more of a theme garden. That way you don't have to forego that wonderful asset. You just might not want to frame your Midwestern home with a lava rock accented landscape.
And vice versa, don't do a Midwestern theme somewhere else.
Totally. So the part of Florida that I love, I refer to as Pinellas County, Florida. One of my favorite restaurants, which I will leave unnamed, had a huge planting berm built up out in the front of the parking lot that also had the marquee for the restaurant in it. And it was built out of Wisconsin headstones, boulders that are like the size of your head. They're pink and gray and tan. It just did not look like it belonged there. It certainly didn't look coastal in appearance.
So here in the Midwest, what do we have to work with?
Most of what we have in the Midwest is some product of glacial till. The glaciers moved across the Midwest and much of the northern part of the United States, and they deposited lots of stone.
Scraped it up, dropped it down when the glacier
That's
melted
right.
or moved back.
Yeah, or when it receded from melting. And river rock is the common blend of these stones. The river rock is really kind of a mixture of all the various colors that we have to choose from here in the Midwest, which there are many. You've got gray blues, you got pink, you got bone white, light tans, green grays. You can do them all as a mono color type presentation that is something that be in keeping with, say, a modern style home. And you can use those stones either in a blend or lean it towards one color that's harmonious or directly in contrast to your home.
So these river rocks, are we talking about like pebbles that you would walk on for a walkway or larger things?
Both, Mike. The aggregates are really important things to keep in mind. If it gets to be much larger than, say, an inch to an inch and a half, it's difficult to walk on, and it's even harder to drive on. It's going to be the smaller aggregates that stay in place for things like gravel patios, gravel walkways, and gravel drives.
So that's a top dress, basically, is what you're talking about with the smaller stones.
Yes.
So how else would we use the materials found in the Midwest, larger or smaller?
You could use them as, like, say, outcroppings or accents, and you would do that by trying to set the stone, oversized stones, into the landscape in key areas. One key area is where a walkway bends to head towards the house. You might have some stone accents at the bend, and that kind of adds to the reason there's a bend in the path. People do that with ornamental plants as well. You could mix the two together. But the thing you want to keep in mind is to position and place these boulders in the most naturally appearing way you can. And the easiest way to do that is to kind of submerge part of them in the earth so that they don't look like they just fell from the sky into your yard.
So how is what we might do in Illinois or Iowa or Wisconsin different than the hardscaping you might find in the desert Southwest?
I think the main difference is the materials you choose. But in the Southwest, you know, xeriscaping is a real-life situation out there.
And xeriscaping is?
Xeriscaping is drought-tolerant landscaping or high-heat landscapes. Those are becoming relevant and popular in the Midwest, but having them look deserty or southwestern in appearance or style might be in conflict with Midwestern homes. You might see this in front of Ancho Agave, a restaurant here in town that serves Latin cuisine. You might see something southwestern looking in a theme landscape, but just for the front entrance landscape, that's hard to pull off. So you can do the xeriscaping principles with lots of rock used as a surface cover, as well as accents and outcroppings, and to kind of direct where people go, and then populate it with plants that are heat and exposure lovers, and then you get the best of all the elements without it looking desert-like.
This seems low maintenance, harder to install than to plant most things, but after that, not much work at all?
That's right, virtually none. The only work that might occur is if there was some damage, you know, say a snowplow hit it or something like that, but unfortunately, you have to pay for rocks a lot of times. They're expensive as 20 cents a pound in some areas, and that's a lot to pay for rock. But once it's there and it's installed correctly, you should never have to worry about it again.
So I had a river rock walkway that had bluestone tiles sort of set into it, and nothing was set in place, right? So the stuff would move around and shift. I just used a garden rake to sort of smooth out and redistribute the gravel and then sort of place the bluestones back into where they should go. You mentioned to me at one point about using a broom would even work at some,
right,
in some cases.
The last step, after you water the plants and do all the dry cleanup, the last step is you brush those stones, and it kind of makes the flat surfaces rise up, and it gives it a nice flat groomed appearance, which will help you with maintenance.
So the downside to some of these materials, I assume there's always a plus and a minus.
Rocks absorb heat all day, and especially dark-colored rock. So if you have a planting pallet that would be sensitive to heat, you would not want to use those plants in a stone top-dress landscape. Now, even the light-colored river rock blends and Merrimack stone, which is kind of a rusty brown, it's still rock, and even though it's not dark in color, it collects heat all day, and then the heat is conducted through the soil and also upwards back to where the plants are growing. So you have to give that some careful consideration.
Plants that might be sensitive to that?
Broadleaf evergreens, particularly Japanese maples, a lot of the spring bloomer, kind of the delicate plants, azaleas, rhododendron, holly.
Can this stuff trap leaves and litter and stuff like that?
Yeah, and I think that is a big part of the landscape industry's last step in grooming that stone. Using large aggregate coarse stones is a great way to get blown in litter and leaf hung up in your low maintenance landscape, which is now no longer low maintenance. And a lot of times that can be alleviated just by having a smaller aggregate that lays flat and smooth, and there's nothing there to catch whatever blows by.
If you have any gardening or landscaping questions about hardscapes or plants and growing things, get in touch and share your questions, and we might answer them on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Support for WGLT's Grow comes from FS Custom Turf by Evergreen FS. FS Custom Turf includes a team of specialists, including a certified turf specialist and a tree doctor to care for yards and trees. Products and services detailed at evergreen-fs.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Is it still a mistake if you didn't know you were making a mistake? WGLT correspondent Brianna Groh shares a next-to-normal storyteller's account of an innocent but still embarrassing oops.
Len Childers grew up an Air Force brat, which meant he and his family moved a lot. From age 3 to 7, Childers lived in Germany in a town called Ankum. It was there in their four-story apartment building in 1977 that Childers made his first best friend, Paula.
Who was also my age, and she was the best friend a six-year-old boy could possibly want or hope to have. She loved bugs, she loved climbing trees, she loved marbles, all the things that boys love. And we would hang out. We were inseparable. We would hang out every Saturday morning. Her mom would take her younger brother, PJ, to the grocery store and bring back sweet tarts. I remember there were three packs of sweet tarts, and she would give me one, and Paula one, and PJ would get one. And then Paula and I would leave PJ by himself and then go play somewhere else.
Paula lived in the apartment just below the Childers. On this particular Saturday, the two were in Childers' room playing with Tinker Toys.
We were having a grand old time, and then somehow the subject turned to, and I don't know if I brought it up or if she brought it up, it turned to the people on TV, on soap operas, right? So, and we were trying to figure out why did the adults on soap operas, on TV always get into bed naked? And why were they always having a good time, and why was it always such a big deal? Because we just didn't understand why that was. I don't know whose idea it was, if it was mine or hers, but we decided that it would be a good idea to explore this and find out, right? So we both took our clothes off, and I don't think we really understood, like, there were different body parts. I mean, it just didn't occur to me that girls had different body parts and I had. I mean, I knew, but I didn't really think that there was anything exciting about that, and I don't think she thought that either. Excuse me. So we both took off our clothes, and we got into bed under my Superman sheets in my twin bed, and we pulled the covers all the way up because that's what we remember. How they would get into bed at first, and they would get under the covers. And we kind of sat there for a little bit and both stared at the ceiling. We didn't really look at each other. And I think we were just waiting for something magical to happen. We just didn't know what that would be. We thought there would be something that would happen. At one point, I turned to Paula, and she turned to me, and we were like, is this it? And so we decided that we were going to put our clothes back on. So I got out of bed, she got out of bed, we put our clothes back on. I quickly put my underwear on and my shirt on. For some reason, it made sense to me to put my underwear on and then my shirt. While Paula just skipped the underwear and just pulled on her pants and her shirt. Now, to me, this blew my mind. Like, it was incredulous to me that somebody would put pants on without underwear. Like, t-shirts go on before your shirt and underwear goes on before your pants. That, you know, so I got really caught up in that. Like, I just got stuck, and I was like, you didn't put your underwear on. And Paula said, but your mom might come in. And my mom was not a small woman. She was a German woman. And so it was ironic that we lived in Germany, but she was a German woman, 5'10", probably a 180. She was not a small woman. And she, Paula said, "I don't want your mom to come in." And I was like, "Pshaw." I mean, I had my underwear on, my shirt on, we're okay. So as I was pulling my pants up, they were probably about to my knee, my mom came up behind me. She'd come into my room, and Paula was just like this, stuck. She had her clothes on, but she saw me with my pants to my knees. And my mom came up behind me and just pulled my pants up the rest of the way and buttoned them up and said, in her thick German accent, "Paula, I think it's time for you to go home now." And Paula was like, "Yes, ma'am, okay." And she left.
Childers thought he'd narrowly escaped trouble and went on with his Saturday as usual until after he'd finished dinner.
I was playing on the living room floor after dinner, and all of a sudden, my mom comes up to me, and she did the full name thing, right? So I go by Len, but my full name is Leonard James Childers. So she did the full name thing. "Leonard James Childers, come with me." And so she grabbed me by the arm, and she whisked me to the door, and I was like, "What did I do, Mom?" And she said, "You be quiet. Just come with me."
Childers marched downstairs with his mother to Paula's apartment, still unsure what he could have done to upset her.
And my mom knocked on Paula's door, and her mom opened the door. And I remember the scene. Her mom was at the door. Her father was sitting in a lazy boy chair watching sports. PJ, her little brother, was sitting on the floor playing in the living room. And she had two twin sisters, Denise and Shannon. And Denise and Shannon poked their head out simultaneously, one above the other, as her mom opened the door. And Paula was the only one that was out of sight. She was in the room. And so when her mom opened the door, she said, "Oh, hello, yes, what can I help you with?" And she said, "Hello, is Paula home?" And of course she's home. I mean, she's six, and you know, it's 6 o'clock in the evening. So her mom said, "Yeah, hang on just a sec. Paula, come out." And so Paula came out of into the hallway. And of course, there's Denise and Shannon and PJ on the floor and Dad and Mom. And everybody's looking at us. And I'm sitting there, I'm just racking my brain, trying to figure out, what is my mom doing? Like, where is this going? And as Paula walked out of her pocket came Paula's underwear, hanging from her fingers, saying, "I think these belong to you."
Childers was mortified. His mother took him home, and he buried himself under those Superman sheets. The next time he saw his friend, neither of them mentioned what had happened.
But I will tell you this, for the rest of my time in school, I did not ask a girl to take her clothes off or get into bed with me, because I learned my lesson from my mom.
Childers now works as a school social worker in Unit 5 schools. He says that lesson from his mom was more of an unspoken one.
No, not at all. She never brought it up again, and I just kind of knew that, you know, after the reveal, I was so mortified that I just knew that I wasn't supposed to do that, and I wasn't going to do it again. And the next time I played with Paula, I never brought it up, and she didn't bring it up, and we just kind of knew. We just didn't do it.
So the fact that you didn't get caught for the original infraction means that there was no discussion about that either. So how did you figure out that, oh, that's why they do that on the soap operas? And did you have a moment of like, oh, that's why?
Yeah, I don't think I did, actually. The moment was so embarrassing. It was such an, oh my gosh, oops, you know, I can't believe, you know, she found her underwear, that I didn't even think about it again. And it just never came to my mind that, you know, that was wrong, or, you know, it didn't pop in my mind, and she never brought it up again. So it was just kind of a weird thing.
I think it's surprising that you can remember something like that from so young. Was it just how intensely embarrassing that was?
I think it was that. This particular girl that I was friends with, we were inseparable. She really was my first truly best friend that I spent large amounts of time with. And, you know, it meant a lot to me. And I remember she moved away before we moved away. And that was really traumatic for me to lose that best friend. So that story always sticks in my head. There are other stories that stick in my head about her, but that one is the big one that sticks in my head. And ironically, I Facebook friended her a couple years ago, and I relayed that story to her, and she didn't remember any of it. Like so I don't know if she blocked it out or if she just like was like, yeah, it just didn't even register for me. So I don't think her mom talked to her about it either.
Sometimes, Chowder says, it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'm Brianna Groh.
You can attend a special Halloween edition of the Next to Normal Story Slam Friday, October 25th. Storytelling begins at 7:30 p.m. at the McLean County Center for the Performing Arts in Bloomington. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham, Eric Stock, Darnisha Mitchell, Mike McCurdy, Patrick Murphy, and Brianna Groh. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.